This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views and insights of the most experienced and accomplished mediators in the profession. We'll share the stories of conflict and lessons learned from mediating challenging and intriguing disputes. You'll hear stories about how conflict affected the lives of those involved in the conflict and how resolution of disputes through mediation provided them with the ability to move forward unburdened by an ongoing dispute. Through our discussions, you will gain insight in how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation, whether you're a mediator, attorney, or have been or contemplate being involved in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbiter with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Len litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998, joining ADR Services on its panel of neutrals in 2008. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. And now your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone. And thank you for joining us for Season 5 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast that will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We are brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. In each podcast, you will hear a story about conflict, the impact that conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Now, many of the details of the story you are about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality essential to mediation while also conveying the essential elements of the conflict and its resolution. Joining me today, we are really fortunate to have Jerry Green. Jerry and I recently became acquainted, and she's a full-time mediator and discovery referee. She successfully mediated and presided over nearly 1,000 cases, perhaps more by now, I think, and in a variety of areas, personal injury, medical malpractice, business, employment, real estate, landlord-tenant, insurance coverage, civil rights and disability rights, police misconduct, probate, elder abuse. I could go on, but if I keep going on, that's all we'll hear is about Jerry, and Jerry will not have a chance to talk about the story that is going to be the center of this podcast. Now, understand that Jerry's approach to dispute resolution is shaped by that diverse background that she has as a litigator, representing both plaintiffs and defendants, and as general counsel, and her own management experience in the hospitality industry. Her commitment to the settlement process is demonstrated by her early immersion in a case and connection with counsel, and she works with the parties to realistically assess risks and impediments to resolution. She prepares extensively, has exceptional listening skills, and an even-handed approach that leads her to help the parties reach just incredibly creative solutions for intractable problems. As I said, I go on and on, but Jerry, welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution, and you've got a story to tell us today.
Well, thank you, Len. Yeah, I want to add on that I come to this as a trial lawyer. I grew up in a world that was, in a legal world that when you used to try cases, and I was in court every day for 25 years, 30 years, and worked at the same time as a settlement conference judge for the court. So hence the breadth of experience in a wide variety of areas. And this particular case that I want to talk to you about today was a constructive eviction case, which are based on habitability issues. These cases are traditionally not very emotional because, unlike your regular landlord-tenant case where people were still living in the house and they're dealing with each other or in the unit, the constructive eviction, they've already left. And so really, we're just talking about filling in the gaps, picking up the pieces, and everybody moving on. They've physically already moved on. This case came to me, and I picked up the phone, as I usually do, and called counsel. Defense counsel says to me, "Well, Jerry, I'd really like to do this in person. I have the property's owned by an estate in a trust, and all of the heirs want to come and be part of the discussion about resolving this case, and their spouses." So I'm like, "Well, sure." So I this was a case where the plaintiff's counsel was remote, and he wanted to stay remote. He didn't want to come in, so we did it hybrid. And the defense and their spouses all came to the office. So eight people walked in, eight clients and two lawyers walked in. The insurance rep was on the screen. And in another breakout room, we had plaintiff's counsel. So it became very clear to me when I got into the session that the defendants, they had flown in from all over the state to be here, that what they really wanted or needed was an opportunity to be together and grieve the loss of their parent that left them this property. So I texted plaintiff's counsel and said, "I think I'm going to be a while in here. and why don't you and your client go have breakfast and I'll come back in an hour and let me work on these folks. So work with these folks." So we started in, and I learned that this was a large California agribusiness family, multi-generational family, real estate holdings and farm and agribusiness all over the state of California. And this particular house had been the house that their father had built for them, and they had grown up in. And it was a 90-acre farmland with horse barns and stables, because mom had been a show equestrian and she had her horses there. And he, by hand, built this house for their family. He had died a few years before, and mom had stayed on, kept her horses, and took care of the property until she had to be put in a nursing home because of dementia. And at that point, the kids didn't quite know what to do with the property, so they let it fall into disrepair or just be empty, which ultimately resulted in a bit of disrepair. When mom died, one of the kids, we'll call him Bobby, was going to, and these are, we're not kids, we're in their 50s and 60s at this point, he decided he would take over the property and run the farm and the horse stables and stuff. And that was on track, and he had a massive heart attack a month after mom passes away. And so now the family has to figure out, do we save the house for him? What do we do? They're all in different places. Everybody's doing different things. So they have a friend who is a horse therapist. She helps horses that are struggling with injury and uses those horses in a horse therapy, animal assisted therapy for people. And so she had just recently lost her accommodations due to a fire. So she needed a place, urgently needed a place for her horses and for herself to live and run this business. So it was a perfect situation for everybody. And so, and they were friends, and they got together and said, "Great, you take over the property, we'll lease out the farm. And you and meanwhile, we'll figure out what's going to happen with Bobby." But they were such good friends, and it was such an emotional time. Even though one of the owners was a realtor, they didn't fill out the form. They used a car real estate lease, and they didn't fill out and check the boxes and have everybody initial and sign where they needed to, because they were friends and they were distraught. So here we are with an ambiguous agreement where both parties believe something vastly different. Defendants believe that they had had this offered their family home to the horse therapist for a year while they were waiting for Bobby to his prognosis to become clear, and plaintiffs believe something else. When I went in there and realized, oh, they thought they were going to take this property over for that, for the family, and plaintiffs thought it, that's where they were going to stay. That this was a long term. This was a long term relationship. So they got in, put a lot of money into repairing the property, repairing the stables and the corrals and the things for the horses, and started running their business.
Not the typical things that a tenant would do. I mean, in terms of. But let me just back up. The expectation was that they would be in there for a long time, but as still as a tenant, right?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, the thought occurred to me, if she's dealing with horse therapy, they're going to need a very large space to deal with this. Maybe even a very large couch. I don't know. I don't know how they work, but in any event, this needed to be repaired. And everybody recognized that, right?
Yes. And so the premises, and so everybody, you know, the family, the owners, and the tenants worked together to build, make the stables work for her, make the so her business could proceed. And they worked on the house, which had, you know, had leaks. It happened to be that year where in the Central Valley, all of a sudden, after years of drought, we had a huge amount of rain. So all of a sudden, this house that had been okay started having leaks, sewage backups, you know, mold, you know, issues that hadn't been readily apparent to the family that didn't live there and hadn't been in the house when it, you know, suffered a real rainstorm. To see what was going on. So there were lots of problems with the house. There was a lot of money put into the stables to make it a viable operation business-wise. And, you know, but everybody was looking at it differently. Meanwhile, Bobby gets better. And it was a few months, but I don't think 100% better, but better enough that he now is going to the premises, the property, to fix things. He is anticipating when the year is done that he'll be able to move in. So he's happily fixing things and moving along. When the year comes up, where the owners tell tenants, okay, your year is up, it's time for you to go. And tenants go, what are you talking about? We have this business going. We've been dealing with these leaks and mold and sewage backups and all this stuff with you and for you. And so owners say, well, and we don't have any place to go. We weren't planning on having to leave. Owners say, we'll give you 6 months free rent and we'll help you find a place. They thought that solved the problem. Tenants saw that as, well, we're living in a place that's uninhabitable. Of course, you'll give us 6 months free rent. Right? Somehow there was a huge miscommunication.
Let me just back up and interject something. The dispute, once it hits the courts or once it hits the dispute stage, it's couched in terms of a habitability case, correct?
Yes.
Could you just give the audience a very brief background on what typical habitability cases are?
So habitability cases are usually filed as, there are things like negligence, breach of implied warranty of habitability and of quiet enjoyment, intentional infliction of emotional distress, breach of contract, those kinds of causes of action, breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Most of those oftentimes are covered by the insurance on the property. And so there is coverage counsel or coverage there as well. And if the tenant moves out, they are entitled to, in a lot of counties, this is jurisdictional, but in a lot of counties are entitled to attorney's fees, are entitled to treble damages if it was a wrongful eviction. Rent differentials. If they have to go rent someplace that's more expensive, they get a rent differential that is then trebled. So they can be wildly expensive in certain jurisdictions, and now throughout California, laws have changed that providing certain plaintiffs with certain rights that didn't exist before.
Although the case is set up as a in a legal framework as a habitability case, what I'm hearing doesn't sound exactly like the typical habitability case. You're not having a tenant fixing everything to make it accommodate the business and then say, well, even though I've been involved with this, you're responsible for making it habitable, and so now we're in this other legal framework. This is a very confusing situation that we're going to get into just a little bit more right after we take a break. I'm Len Levy. We're on Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, and I'm speaking with Jerry Green.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitrations, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy. I'm chatting with Jerry Green about a horse psychologist and a family and a dispute that is kind of took the relationship off the rails. How did they go, Jerry, if you would, how did they go from everybody helping each other out in circumstance to now we're at loggerheads?
Well, I like to say it was a perfect storm that the, as I talked about a little bit earlier, there had been a drought in California, and this comes up quite often now. There had been a drought in this area, and there hadn't been any rain on buildings for years. And then we had an onslaught. And the onslaught caused all of these buildings that had been roofs and, you know, structures that had been standing for a long time without any problems to all of a sudden have tremendous structural problems. And in this situation, it caused this old farmhouse that was built 100 years ago to really have problems such that the tenants had to move their family and to live in just one fifth of the house pending repairs of the rest of it. During that time, I think I also said that Bobby had started to recover. And he was taking the reins of fixing things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he was the right person for the job or knew how to do it. And I think he was struggling a little bit understanding that this business that had taken over here was a horse business that needed peace and quiet for the horses and the patients. The people patients that were there getting therapy. So, you know, he'd come in to fix stuff unnoticed, and he didn't notify anybody he was coming in his big heavy truck, thinking he was doing a good thing and disrupting everyone. So tenants could not continue. Their business was being disrupted on a regular basis. The things that they needed repaired weren't getting repaired in a way that was actually allowing them to use the premises as they needed to. And this went on for a few months during that 6-month free rent period. And finally they said, enough, we can't live here any longer. And they moved on. But it cost them a tremendous amount of money to move. They hadn't intended on expending that kind of money. And they had to pay a lot more in rent now to run new premises than they had anticipated. So they filed a lawsuit. Their lawyers are lawyers that handle these cases all the time, and they generally posture a case at a very high rate, meaning that the number that they're demanding is a very large number that is can be very upsetting for defendants when they think about how this might end up, right? Or what their exposure is. So the emotions about that in defendants' room were very high. But that's how we got here. They couldn't understand why our friend is suing us and how can she be suing us for this amount of money. And the friend couldn't understand why they didn't get it, that she needed peace and quiet and a place to live for her business and her family.
And that's what led them to contact you and see if you could untangle this.
Yes. Yeah, so there's a lawsuit filed and they ended up seeking mediation. Now, another part of this is that there are these cases oftentimes by statute get statutory attorney's fees or contractual attorney's fees, depending on where you are and what the contract says. This particular case was, the lease was a California Association of Realtors lease that has a standard attorney's fees mediation clause. If you agree by signing the lease to mediate any disputes, and if a request for a mediation is made and either side refuses to mediate, attorney's fees will be awarded to the prevailing party. As I said earlier, these guys got together so fast. They were California. One of the owners, the one couple that did the lease, are realtors. And they used their standard California real estate lease. But they were so upset that they didn't check the boxes. And they didn't put in the lease term of a year that they thought they had. They thought they put it in there, but it wasn't in the lease because it was friends going, yeah, you need a place to live. We need a place to here, sign here. And they were convinced that it was in the lease and that everybody knew it was just a one-year lease term, but the lease didn't say that. And when the request for mediation came from plaintiffs, they responded in an ambiguous way, which plaintiffs took as a refusal to mediate. So now we're looking at hefty attorney's fees. So it pushes the numbers way up for settlement purposes. And and added to that, the realtors family members that had the lease were, I was uncomfortable telling their brethren, oh, they screwed up. Because I didn't want to make this the family situation any worse than it already was. Right. So I saw it, I'm looking at it, I pulled their lawyer aside and said, we have a problem. Mm. But I'm not sure that we want to tell everybody about this problem because it's just going to cause more family dysfunction and heartache. That was the gravamen of what was going on at the time. The insurer did not recognize in the beginning that there was a attorney's fees potential exposure. And so that was the other issue. The carrier wasn't on board with the fact that there might be some significant exposure here. So there were those were the pieces that were going on in the defendant's room, the different parties. In addition to this family hadn't been physically in the same place to grieve the loss of their mom, the loss of property, what they're going to do with it, how that the property wasn't just a property. It was all the family possessions were left in the house and they were still there. And they were, reminiscing about all of those rocking chairs and the furniture and the artwork on the walls and things. This structure had so much emotional connection to each and every one of them that they spent a lot of time showing me pictures of the furniture and the art that they grew up with and that were still there. It was interesting.
So the emotional ties that they had to the property were basically not, had not been addressed or discussed or anything before the mediation took place. How did that become an impediment to resolution, and how did you overcome it?
Well, step back for a second. As a lawyer, I always wanted to protect my clients, and I take, you know, when we went into mediation, I would be very protective of them, of, you know, I don't want to re-traumatize them. I don't want this process to hurt them anymore. As a mediator, I've learned that actually what litigants need a lot of times is an opportunity to be, to tell their story, to tell their story to a neutral being, which, as much as our process, whatever our process is here in the justice system, we don't really offer them that. They don't get to, you know, they tell their stories to their lawyers, but they're paying them to listen. They tell their, and to be on their side. They tell their story in deposition, but that's not a comforting place to tell your story, or nor is trial. And but they're really, what they're really looking for a lot of times is just an opportunity to talk about how they were hurt. And it was very clear to me that these people were hurt by, that the whole family was hurt by the chain of events that had little to do with this lawsuit. Had more to do with the fact that they lost their mom, they lost, their brother was, you know, struggling, that they were, that this this family institution, this farm, was, you know, potentially going to be lost as well. They didn't know what was going to happen with it, and there was just so much emotion going on that I realized they needed time to grieve all of it. So what ended up happening was I spent probably 90 minutes with them in the beginning talking through all of this, and then realized, you guys need to talk some more. We let them have the conference room without telling them this, sent in a lot of food and drinks so they could just grieve together. And the lawyers and I went off, and the insurance rep went off and worked about settling the case.
Right. So basically what you are dealing with, or what we've referred to in the past as below the line issues, issues that really have nothing to do with driving the dispute, but which create the impediment to resolving the dispute.
Yes.
So the demand, I assume, was going to, it was a dollar amount demand of some sort. Yeah. This is going to seem strange, I think, but I'm getting the impression that the dollar amount was something that in and of itself was less an impediment to resolving the case than the below the line issues.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was coverage, and, you know, I worked with insurance, the carrier's rep, to come to a conclusion about the liability issues and, you know, the risks and stuff later on. And so there was coverage, and there was an amount of coverage. I don't know how much would have been covered. And there was, the family was very wealthy. The dollar amount was only something that was an emotional discussion. So I did not want to talk about numbers with them, because it was almost like I was putting a number on the value of these memories, right? The value of this pain, which had nothing to do with this lawsuit. So I did, went out and had a cup of coffee, a common area, and the lawyers and were out there as well. And we started talking. I said, you know, do you think we could get in a room and see if we can work this out with the carrier? And so we got into a room, and it took a very long time. As I explained earlier, the carrier wasn't seeing the exposure, because the California laws are very odd, and carriers are usually not here. And this ambiguity in the lease created other problems. So there was a lot of legal discussion that had to go on, as well as kind of coming up with a number that would work. And we went back and forth, but never talked about the numbers with the clients until we were really close. So you just couldn't do it either.
This is really a very, very good illustration of some things that people are going to have to keep in mind about the nature of the dispute being one thing and the resolution being in an entirely different universe. And we're going to go into another universe right after we take a break. And we're going to continue our chat with Jerry Green on Masters of Dispute Resolution.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy. We're chatting with Jerry Green, and we're talking about a dispute that has a hoarse whisperer element, a below-the-line issues element. We have insurance elements. There are a lot of elements here, and Jerry made some sense of it and got the parties to a point where resolution was possible. So how that happened, and we were discussing off camera, but how that happened involved educating an insurance carrier in part, and also allowing people to deal with their emotions, even though those emotions had nothing to do with settling the case, because the carrier could have settled it without dealing with those emotions, right?
Sure. So this was not a professional policy, liability policy. So this was the kind of policy where a carrier can just settle it without, doesn't need the consent of the parties. And what was interesting here was that the carrier was very deferential to the emotions of the parties and giving them the opportunity to work through their problems. I was telling you at the break that, you know, I would go back into the room and because I think the family, the defense room, because I think the family needed me to be the recipient of their memories. They needed somebody to hear their memories about growing up. So they'd show me pictures of their first pony or their pony ride or them working on the farm or times with their parents. They needed that. And it was very obvious. So I would spend time throughout the day giving them that opportunity. But I realized they were not people. Talking numbers to them about this very visceral, emotional thing was not going to get the case settled. So I was able to get the carrier and the defense counsel to come into a different room where we could talk about the legal issues and exposure and numbers and see if we could get somewhere.
So a couple of things come to mind. One is educating the carrier's representative. And the second thing that at least comes to my mind is you're still having to deal with a human being, the carrier's representative, who has to make a decision and justify that decision to whoever he answers to or she answers to. How did you do that?
So one of the big stumbling blocks on the legal side to settlement, impediments to settlement, was this lease and the attorney's fees clause and the ambiguity in the responses. Plaintiffs said, well, yeah, we responded, they refused, therefore they have to pay attorney's fees. Mint carrier's like, well, that wasn't good enough. We did what we needed to do. Our lawyers did what they needed to do to satisfy the lease requirements. But it was ambiguous. So I had plaintiff's counsel on the phone. I had defense counsel and insurance rep in front of me. And I said, there has to be law on this. I'm a car mediator. I know that this clause is in all of real estate sales agreements, that there has to be law on what's good enough and what triggers attorney's fees. Let's find it and figure out what it is, and then we can decide. We'll know what the exposure is. And both parties scurried around, and of course there wasn't a true answer. There rarely is, but if you're going to sit here and tell me you know the answer and that's for sure, then show me why. And if not, then we should talk about what we're going to do about it. So it took quite some time for everybody to go look at the law and basically come back and go, we don't know. Both sides, we don't know. Well, when you say we don't know, that means, the dollars. Because it means you're going to pay a lot of attorney's fees. You're going to pay a lot to get to a point where somebody in a black robe tells you. Right. So that's what that means. So they, that made them both get real. And then we basically spent the next few hours going back and forth between plaintiff's counsel and plaintiffs and defense counsel and insurance rep. We couldn't come to a number because the rep still needed to get her supervisors on board. She said, you're going to have to write me a letter that explains why they have to, because they just don't get it, why they're going to have to cough up this much money. They just don't get it. But I see what you're saying, but you're better at explaining it than I am, she said to me. So I said, well, what about if I do a mediator's proposal? And I gave her a range, gave everybody a range, all sides, and explained my reasoning as to why I came up with that number. Now, a mediator's proposal, in my view, is something that I write up. I give a number after listening to everything, thinking it's not a number that I think is going to happen at trial. It's a number that after hearing everybody, I think, well, this might get this done. but nobody's going to be thrilled with it, but, it's just close enough to what they want that they might do it. And I put it in writing and I give them a period of time to think about it. And if one party accepts, but the other party rejects, the party that rejects never knows that the other party accepted. So it's a way of not having to give an offer, you get to save face. You can have an opportunity to make a deal without having to risk, further discussion about you being stuck at that number. So I came up with a number and I did that. I wrote a very explanatory letter about why I believed that to be a good number. And ultimately, everybody agreed. And when so it wasn't known at the end of the mediation if it was going to get resolved. But I was so taken with the fact that when the 8 defendants walked out, they hugged me and said, thank you for listening. We didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. We thought we were going to come here and it would be like a trial. And it wasn't. It was like, you listen to us and we're all going to dinner now. You want to come? And it was lovely. But it was lovely to have given them that opportunity. And the folks in the other room, the plaintiffs, were happy to get some money, be able to get on with their lives, have their businesses, and move on. And so it was one of those moments. It was a perfect result to a very difficult day for everyone.
Well,
You've illustrated something that is that raised a question to me about what could the attorneys in this case, because they're both sides are represented, what could the attorneys have done prior to the mediation to facilitate the resolution? Or maybe they did everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was, as I've been saying, I think it was a case that the only way it was going to get resolved was if everybody got a chance to be heard. They needed the opportunity to say, I was hurt by this. I felt betrayed by my friend. We walked into the situation, the rental situation, believing that this was whatever their beliefs were, and we feel betrayed. I don't know that lawyers can help you through that as much as being in an environment where some neutral person listens and says, you know, that was hard. It was hard.
It seems in this instance, though, Jerry, that the attorneys were really, or maybe I'm misreading something here. The attorneys were not aware of this as an issue. So they were looking at it, they're approaching it from this is the legal framework. This is what we have to prove. This is what we have to, how we can defend it, things of that nature. The emotional release that allows the plaintiff to accept it. I mean, because we're dealing with a plaintiff who, I've got to assume that the amount of the initial demand was not got the case settled.
Like 10 times more, yeah.
right. So was the plaintiff's expectation, were those unrealistic going in?
You know, that could be. I don't know if when lawyers posture very high demands, if they take the time to explain to their clients that it is not this number that you should be thinking about, it's the end number. I always tell clients when I'm dealing with this, especially when I'm dealing with a situation where the demands are huge, or you know, the there's a huge disparity, and the clients are really upset by that number, that they have to not think about the starting numbers. The only number that matters is the last number. Starting numbers are strategy. People use different strategies. I am not going to tell anybody how to run their case, but I will tell litigants, you know, that's what lawyers do. You think about the end number. That's all that matters. I'm not sure that all lawyers do that they explain to their clients that their demands are simply a strategy. It's not, you know, don't expect to go there or to end there. I don't know. Well, I wish they would. Right. I don't know if they do.
Right. When they don't do that, it's our role as mediators to become kind of an agent of reality. Here are some risks you might consider. Here are some possible outcomes that you might want to consider that are not necessarily what even close to that starting number. This also illustrates why, as mediators, we typically don't start with numbers because then we have, wait a minute, I'm giving up X number of dollars. No. You're not giving up X number of dollars. That was not a real number.
Exactly. It's impossible for either side. And I don't think lawyers get in there oftentimes, especially in these kinds of cases, would get in there to know this. But when a party feels betrayed, and both parties did here, there's not a number that, because it's almost like if they accept a number, that means that's all the pain in their heart is worth. They lost a friend. They feel betrayed by somebody in a very vulnerable, well, they're both extremely vulnerable walking into this deal. And they feel that their friends betrayed them. There was not a number that they were ever going to be happy with.
I hearken back to my first torts class in law school. And my torts professor, it was Fred Lauer, said, you know, one of the most difficult things we have to do is to translate pain and suffering into dollars, because they are not equivalent currency. And so one of the challenges as mediators is to have the parties accept a resolution or agree to a resolution that actually translates dollars into pain and suffering. But you were successful here. You read the room. You came up with solutions. I congratulate you. And Jerry, thank you so much for this conversation. I hope to have you back as a guest. I'm delighted to have gotten to know you better over the past few months, actually. And I want to also ask you, if people want to contact you and book you for mediation, what's the best way to do that?
Well, ADR Services, I'm out of the San Francisco office, but you can call any ADR Services to find me. My email through ADR is ggreen@adrservices.com. And my website is greenmediations.com. You're welcome to call me in any of those places.
Thank you, Jerry.
And thanks, Lynn. This was really fun. And I hope that we get to continue this relationship, whether it's on here or anywhere else. It's a lot of fun.
I'm sure. Look, we both grew up, I think, in the San Fernando Valley. I feel like we went to different high schools together, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, mine burned down in the recent fire.
Oh, yes. Palisades. Wow. Yes. Right. Well, thank you, Daryl Wayne, and my engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs, Inc. I hope you'll continue to enjoy the stories that we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.